nostalgic.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's great the way a piece of music can make you feel like it's aimed directly at you. But a song can also be a useful thing for a whole community or a country. Especially a song that has some mileage on it, you know? It helps us look back and see where we've been and maybe where we are now. That's important even if you don't necessarily like what you see.
If a black man should go and fight for his country, yeah.
Three long, hard, blood, miserable years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they fought so well, they even gave them a military.
Oh, we were good with that to him here.
From Dallas, that's the gospel-slash-psychedelic-slash-funk group called The Relatives. The song is What's Wrong with America, and they first sang it during the Vietnam War. Now, 40 years later, they've updated the lyrics to reflect the problems of soldiers, and especially soldiers of color, returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And really, they didn't have to do that much updating at all, just change a country's name and that was it. So today on Soundcheck, on this Martin Luther King Day, we will hear The Relatives, a group that started over 40 years ago, singing songs from what will be their first ever full-length album. Of course, 40 years ago, The Relatives were not the only ones singing songs about the black experience in America or drawing on gospel roots.
Don't you see me down here praying, but the Lord said, go to the devil, the Lord said, go to the devil.
Fans of the late singer Nina Simone often didn't know what to make of her. She could seem remote or lovable or out-and-out hostile. But her talent and her contributions to music and to the struggle for civil rights, well, that's indisputable. Nina Simone died 10 years ago this year, and on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're taking a closer look at an icon whose story is complex and whose songs have become anthems. In fact, just last year, the bassist and singer Michel Indigeocello recorded a whole album of a tribute to Nina Simone. Joining me here in the studio today is the historian Ruth Feldstein. Her upcoming book is called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. Ruth, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
You know, the way we view Nina Simone now, sort of associating her with the civil rights movement, doesn't seem to... That's kind of a new way of approaching Nina Simone, isn't it?
I think it is, yes. At the time when she was making a name for herself, she was enormously popular and enormously controversial, too. She had a huge range of songs, so she wrote about everything, ranging from the death of Martin Luther King to Beatles songs to folk songs. But when I first started doing research on Nina Simone, people involved in the movement and people who had been activists certainly remembered her and remembered her songs as anthems. But I think a lot of people, when they think about music and the civil rights movement, they think about We Shall Overcome.
Right.
They think about This Little Light of Mine.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to my kids'
Eyes on
assemblies
the prize,
for Martin Luther King Day, these are the songs that are
right.
playing. And as a result of how dominant that association is in terms of civil rights music to those kind of freedom songs, other kinds of music have tended to fall off the radar.
Right. So Nina Simone wasn't considered to have written freedom songs per se.
Right.
In fact, my understanding was, you know, here was this woman from the South who had some classical training and who really felt that that was her sort of intended path and that she kind of got pulled in all these other directions. In your research,
right.
does that is get
exactly,
borne out?
Exactly. Simone was born in 1933 in a small town in North Carolina, and she started playing the piano at a very young age. By the time she was 3 years old, Her mother did domestic work. Her father was mostly a handyman.
How did she have access to a piano?
The town came together, whites and blacks, in this rural southern town, and did fundraising for her to be able to afford piano lessons. So she was classically trained. When she was a teenager, she ended up at Juilliard for a year, and she really hoped to go to the very prestigious Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She didn't get in 1951, which was devastating to her. At that point, she stayed in Philadelphia. She continued her own classical training, but she needed money to support herself and for her own lessons. So she started playing the piano at an Atlantic City nightclub. And then, under pressure from her first boss, started singing and eventually starting to write her own songs. And by 1958, she had had her first hit.
With
I Love You, Porgy.
Let's hear that early hit from Nina Simone. She's one of the topics of Ruth Feldstein's forthcoming book called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever, and I'll be glad. Yes, I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. I've got my man.
Just a little bit of I Loves You, Porgy, originally released by the late Nina Simone in 1958. We're talking about the singer, songwriter, pianist with historian Ruth Feldstein, who teaches at Rutgers, and her book is due later this year called How It Feels to Be Free. The story of, you know, a young woman making her way in the music business and her boss insists that she start singing instead of, you know, what she wanted to do, which was simply play the piano. We've heard that so often, but my goodness, it worked out so well, didn't it?
Well, I think this song and her background in general really matters, because this song really launched her commercial career. But I think from the outset, you can see, even before she is writing explicitly political songs, that Simone was defying categories. She really blended jazz with blues, with gospel, with classical, the classical training that she'd received. She had a very, very eclectic repertoire.
And, well, and here, George Gershwin did the same thing,
exactly.
You know, with Porgy and Bess.
And people loved her, and they called her this hot new thing, and she was the sensation, and she was sort of the it girl of the moment, but they didn't know how to define her. Mm-hmm. So that from the start, again, she was posing challenges to these conventional cultural categories. And I think that in some way she was poised then to also defy and pose challenges politically, which she did increasingly by 1963.
Now, what's the turning point? The turning point happens in 63, doesn't it?
The turning point happens in 1963. What she calls her first civil rights song was the song Mississippi Goddamn, which she writes in September of 1963. She has just heard about the church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, in which four young girls were killed. And she said later that the song, I forget the exact quote, the song exploded out of her with rage and fury. And it's an incredible song in many ways, lyrically, musically, politically. She contrasts this very rollicking, upbeat rhythm with these lyrics that are just filled with rage and despair a month after the March on Washington, that moment that people think of as the heyday of interracial liberalism and this beautiful moment of solidarity in the civil rights movement. A month later, she is challenging interracial activism. She is challenging a church-based movement that emphasized nonviolence. Mm-hmm. She is challenging assumptions that prejudice and discrimination were Southern phenomenon. So she is really articulating a different kind of political vision than that which many people today think of as being associated with that phase of the civil rights movement.
So when we look back on the civil rights movement, we sort of, in hindsight, have kind of sloughed off the things at the edges and looked kind of at the main, what the media has shown us over the years. But there at one edge was Nina Simone. Is it true that her first reaction to the church bombing was, "I'm going to get a gun,"
right,
and that the song was her second,
right,
perhaps more measured response?
Right. Her husband at the time was a police officer. And so that's, so she said, you know, there were guns, there were materials around the house. And then she said, or she later said, "I don't know anything about guns, but I know about music."
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, those ideas are at the heart of Black Power and are at the heart of the Black Arts Movement, that politically relevant culture is central to Black politics and Black activism. And many scholars today in the last decade have shown that the civil rights movement is not this neat divide between interracial activism in the early 60s and Black Power in the late 60s. But I still think it's very hard to get past that image of Black Power as being associated with the later period and as being associated with Black men in leather jackets,
right,
you know, with their fists up or holding a gun. And here she is in 1963 expressing these ideas.
A woman, an entertainer, not in a leather jacket, but often in a very
long gown. Mm-hmm.
Nina Simone is who we're talking about with the historian Ruth Feldstein. And here is that song from 1963. This recording made the next year in concert, Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet.
Nina Simone recorded in concert 1964 with a version of her first civil rights song, as she called it, Mississippi Goddamn. And we are talking with the historian Ruth Feldstein. Her upcoming book later this year is called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. So it's 5 years between her first appearance on the scene with the hit version of I Love You Porgy, the George Gershwin song, and then writing Mississippi Goddamn. Was she, do you think, Ruth, she was a reluctant kind of icon of the civil rights movement? Did she make her peace with it at some point?
I don't think she ever made her peace with much in her life. Mm-hmm. That's not a quality I would associate with her. I think that she felt compelled to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people who made her feel that way and made her think much more about politics was her very good friend, Lorraine Hansberry. Hansberry was a playwright whose hit play, Raisin in the Sun, had come out a few years earlier, and they were close friends. And Simone explained repeatedly that Hansberry was the person who took her out of herself and made her think about the big picture, about class relations in this country, about race relations in this country. And I think that that's a very important part of Simone's story, because I think it's a link in terms of understanding how important gender was to her Black politics. In song after song after song, in many, many different ways, she made the power of Black women central to her vision of Black liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was she different in 1963 in terms of articulating a Black Power perspective. Not that she was alone by any means, but, you know, it wasn't what people associate as the mainstream. But she also stood out because her vision of Black Power was Black Power that was free of misogyny and that, again, claimed power for Black women. And we see this in Mississippi Goddam, not in the clip that we just listened to, but there's a line where she is rejecting the idea that Black women have to behave in a certain way, be respectable, be ladylike to deserve equal treatment and full rights. And she's saying, no, that's not going to work anymore. Hmm. Her performance of Rage on that song is itself a rejection of that idea.
But Rage, but also with this kind of sardonic humor,
right,
as well.
Exactly. The laughter of the audience is very interesting.
It's kind of a nervous laughter,
yes,
isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. And the idea of calling this a show tune, but the show hasn't been written yet. There are layers of threat, I think, even though people also feel that she was such a mesmerizing performer and made such a magical connection to her audiences, there's a certain kind of discomfort at the same time. And I think that's because there was this assumption that Black women, again, should behave a certain way if they were going to be claiming rights.
Now, before Nina Simone, you know, you had Marian Anderson, the great contralto,
mm-hmm.
Classically trained, and because she was Black, you know, denied access to some of the biggest stages mm-hmm. in this country, although she had a good career in Europe, and who, you know, really when portrayed herself as a lady, you know, very elegant, very classical. At some point, when Nina Simone sort of grasps onto both the racial and especially the gender roles mm-hmm. and the gender wars, she begins to change her appearance, doesn't
mm-hmm.
she?
She changes her appearance. She becomes, she is wearing clothing and hairstyles more associated with Black cultural nationalism and with Africa specifically. She wears her hair more often natural, Afro, though, again, she moves between lots of different styles. She performs with musicians from Africa as well. But I think it's important to see with Simone is that, again, she's always blending things and always doing a lot of things at once. So she never discarded the respectability that was associated with being a classically trained musician. She just also said at the same time she could express this rage. She could use other kinds of styles. She could use her body to show herself as an empowered Black woman performer, both on stage and off stage. And
was she, though? Was she empowered? I mean, did she at some point take control of her career and do the things she wanted?
Well, sadly, in her own personal life, that was not the case. But I think that in terms of her political activism and the contributions she made politically through her music, control and that assertion of power were central for
mm-hmm.
her.
And so it came out in these kind of angry songs that she would write, in the kind of jokes she would
right.
tell.
Humor, I think, is important. I'm sorry, yes.
And then mm-hmm. well, and then mm-hmm. there's the song Go Limp,
mm-hmm.
which is, this is kind of her shot across the bow in the, both looking at the nonviolence that was kind of the mainstream of the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
looking at it with kind of a, you know, sidelong glance, and perhaps a little dig at the ongoing gender thing as well.
Right. It's a very funny song, too, which, again, stands in such contrast to a song like Mississippi Goddam or another song on that album, Pirate Jenny, which is so full of rage and is a Black woman's fantasy of violence, violent revenge, whereas Go Limp is a spoof of the sexual politics of nonviolent protesters, a spoof of folk music as a genre. So again, her playing with different kinds of musical genres and really questioning the idea of restraint, both in terms of politically, in terms of civil rights activism and self-restraint and nonviolence, and in terms of this emphasis that Black women should show a certain kind of sexual self-restraint and really acknowledging Black women's sexual desires as well.
So the song is called Go Limp. It's another from the late Nina Simone, one of the subjects of Ruth Feldstein's forthcoming book, How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement.
Daughter, dear daughter, take warning from me, and don't you go marching with the NAACP. for they'll rock you and roll you and shove you into bed. And if they steal your nuclear secret, you'll wish you were dead. Singing tu-ra-la, tu-ra-la, tu-ra-la. You get the gist of the song now? When we get to the chorus again, I expect you to sing with us. Oh, mother, dear mother, no, I'm not afraid. For I'll go on that march and I'll return a virgin maid. With a brick in my handbag and a smile on my face and barbed wire in my underwear to shed off disgrace.
The late Nina Simone, 10 years gone this year, and one of the subjects of Ruth Feldstein's forthcoming book, How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement, the song Go Limp, the familiar folk melody that many kids sang in assembly back in the 60s, and here with words that you would not necessarily find kids singing in assembly.
I can't listen to that song without laughing.
It's
no matter
funny.
How many times I hear it, and just this whole question of who or what is going to go limp remains unanswered. Which,
although despite her early protests in the song that she will come back a virgin maid and the barbed wire and the underpants, she actually comes back
exactly
with a kid,
right,
and not a husband. So there's again this kind of acknowledgement of desire and lust, but also of, you know, I can do this
exactly by
myself if you're not going to help.
And at the same time, spoofing this very masculine emphasis within a lot of civil rights activism on this macho posturing by telling the story from the point of view of the woman in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So
now let me, your book's subtitle is Black Women Entertainers, Plural, and the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Nina Simone.
No.
Who else is in this circle?
The cast that I'm focusing on in the book includes Lena Horne, Simone, Mary Makeba, who's a South African woman who spent 10 years in the United States from 1958 to 1968. Abby Lincoln, jazz singer, but also was in several films, and I focus on her film career. Diane Carroll and Cecily Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
So the book goes from 1943, Lena Horne's movie Cabin in the Sky, to Roots in 1976, in which Cecily Tyson had a small but important part.
Right. And Miriam Makeba, who spent a number of years here in New York, you know, was very important on the folk music, the Greenwich Village circuit, you know, very much lionized by people like a young Bob Dylan and that whole crowd.
Right.
So that there were sort of numerous
intersections.
Yeah.
Right. The group that I focus on, this is not a sisterhood by any means, but they were a loosely connected cohort. They had a lot of overlapping circles and friends and acquaintances, and they themselves worked together and collaborated in certain instances. And they had shared sets of concerns. They all took risks when they made the choice to support the civil rights movement and Black activism in their careers as entertainers, even though they did that in very, very different ways. But I think the other thing that unites them is, as I said with Simone, for all of them, gender was an important part of the kind of Black freedom that they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's civil rights, women deserve those civil rights as much as, you know, African Americans.
Right.
So
yeah, exactly.
I guess it was sort of a broader view of what civil rights could mean.
Mm-hmm.
So when she wrote a song like For Women,
would
she have had this kind of loose connection to other women, you know, in her mind?
Yes. For Women is a song that she wrote in 66, and it tells the story of four types. She takes up common stereotypes that circulated in mainstream American culture, the mammy, very subordinate, very overworked, very asexual. She takes up the type of a more sort of sexualized Jezebel and other sort of archetypes of Black women, and she gives these women a voice, and she tells their story, and she expresses their pain, and she expresses their history, and she rejects this degradation of Black women's bodies, of Black women's beauty. She also attends to issues of color consciousness within Black communities that many women at the time were experiencing. And she later said she wrote it because this is what was going on in all Black women's minds all the time.
Mm.
And that's who she wrote it for, even though it became one of her most popular songs in the late 60s. And I think when you listen to a clip of it, it's almost like consciousness raising in song, even though, again, Simone herself did not identify with a women's liberation movement that she associated with white women.
Mm.
Yet you see a lot of the same kinds of arguments and themes that, again, became very important to Black feminism as it really flourished in the 70s.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Four Women from the late Nina Simone as we wrap up here with the historian Ruth Feldstein, who teaches at Rutgers. Her upcoming book later this year will be called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. And Ruth, this has been a fascinating look back at the late Nina Simone.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
My skin is black. My arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again.
Here on Soundcheck, we feature a lot of artists who are releasing their debut albums. It's just one of the things we do. But it's not every day that you get a visit from a group that's putting out its first album after forming more than 40 years ago. Next up, a performance by the Dallas-based gospel funk group, The Relatives. This is Soundcheck.
My skin is yellow. My hair is long.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time to take you a little higher. The Relatives are a gospel group that formed in Dallas back in 1970, led by the Reverend Gene West and his brother, the Reverend Tommy West. Over the next 10 years, they performed their funky brand of spiritual music around the regional gospel circuit. They released a few singles, too, like this one called Evil World. The Relatives called it quits in 1980, but a recent compilation of those old singles sparked new interest in their music, which is perfect for the church, or, as we'll hear later, for much more secular places. Now, more than 40 years after they originally formed, The Relatives are back, and they've released their first official album, called The Electric Word. It was produced by Jim Eno of the band Spoon, and The Relatives joined us about a week ago to perform songs from it in the Green Space, our ground floor performance venue. Here's Let Your Light Shine on Soundcheck. We'll be right back.
That is The Relatives, live on Soundcheck in a special video webcast from The Green Space, our ground floor performance venue. And let your light shine, and let me introduce you to The Relatives. I'm standing next to Reverend Tommy West.
Yes.
Did you just say, take me to the bridge? Was that what
take
I heard?
To the bridge.
So you, a little James Brown thing happening there.
That's it.
Next to Tommy is Tyrone Edwards. Tyrone Edwards. You'll know Tyrone's voice when he hits that high falsetto. Tony Corbett at center stage.
Yes.
Reverend Gene West next to him in the neat shades. Ernest Tarkington behind the congas, also providing vocals. And our back line, our second line, consists of Zach Ernst on guitar, Scott Nelson on bass, Matt Stramiska on drums. They are The Relatives. Ernest, let me start with you over there on the other side of the stage. Before we started today, you were telling me that Let Your Light Shine is an older song and actually has an older name, right?
Yes. When we first started, we called the song Walking On It.
Walking On It. So you've rechristened the song.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Tommy, this is a band that formed in 1970. Over
exactly.
40 years ago.
Yes.
And here you are releasing your first full-length record.
How about that?
It's pretty amazing.
Oh, yes.
Were you expecting this, or was this like a bolt from the blue when people started coming to you and, you know, sort of expressing interest in what
I
you guys
had done?
I
wasn't expecting this. This was a bolt from the blue. It really was. It's a godsend, actually, because I had sort of put it behind me. I went into other fields of ministry, pastoring mm-hmm. the church, and I kind of just put this behind us. And my brother gave me a call and said he received a call, and he told me the whole situation. I said, yeah, okay, all right. You know, but it came to pass. It came across.
And when he said, I got the call, he uh-huh. didn't mean that call. He meant like a literal phone call.
Literal phone call, yes, yeah, from our manager, Newell.
Right. Now, Gene.
Yes, sir.
So you've already mentioned your manager who ran the label Heavy Light, which was, they were the ones who put out that initial set of that compilation of you guys had done a couple of singles in the 1970s. So this was a very kind of modest thing at the beginning.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What was the intent? Did you have it in the back of your mind that if we could just get this sound out there, I know the kids are going to like it?
At different times, it would run across my mind, but it would just run across it.
It wouldn't stay.
No.
Yes. So now you finally have this new recording, and it's produced by Jim Eno from the Austin rock band Spoon.
Right.
Very sought-after indie rock producer. What was he like to work with? Did it sort of push the sound maybe in a little bit of a different direction from what it had been in the 70s?
He didn't try to change anything. he just let us go. He wanted us to bring out that 70s sound.
Right.
So, and he felt that we had it, so.
Now, how did that 70s sound start? Because you guys, you know, you come out of the gospel tradition, but you were, you know, Tommy, it seemed like you guys were clearly listening to other stuff that was
exactly.
happening.
Yes.
Yeah, we was listening to James Brown, Marvin Gaye, different, you know, rock bands, mm-hmm. Eagles.
Really?
Yeah, Beach Boys.
Little Sly in the Family Stone.
Sly. Oh, yeah, all mean Sly. Yeah, and Sam and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And we was sort of, at the time, we was a little ahead of our time. Churches wasn't ready for this, you know. we pursued it anyway, this style. We loved it, and we liked it, and we wanted to do something different. And we wanted to reach not just the church community, we wanted to reach the world.
Right.
So we did this, and we sung it several times in some churches. And the young people, they loved it. But the older people, they just sit there and just dumb their head, just kind of shook their head, you know. But it was all right.
Mm-hmm. Gene, can you introduce this next song? It's called What's Wrong with America. It's on this new record, but this is another older song, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. This is a song that we got together on one day in my mother's dining room. Tommy told me, it's something I want you to hear. And we went back and remembered some things that we had went through with. It would take me too long to tell it, but we remember some of the things that we had went through with in Louisiana.
In Louisiana.
So Thomas said, let's listen to this. So he kind of went over the song, kind of, you know, or with me, and it was pieces. And I said, wait a minute, let's put this here. And let's
so it's been updated a
like
bit.
That, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how we come up with it, and mm-hmm. we begin to like it.
Well, let's hear it. It's a live performance by The Relatives, live on stage at the Green Space on Soundcheck. The song is called What's Wrong with America.
What's wrong with America?
isn't it this?
If a black man should go and fight for his country, yeah.
Three long, hard, blood, miserable years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they fought so well, they even gave them a medal of
honor. We were good with that to him here.
In America.
The Relatives performing on Soundcheck. What's Wrong with America? An old song, a new version, from the band's new album, The Electric Word. It's their debut release after 40-plus years of being a band. We'll hear more from The Relatives in a moment, and remember, you can watch video of this performance. It's already been archived on our site. Just go to soundcheck.org. If you're enjoying this Green Space performance, we want you there in person for our next Soundcheck taping. On January 31st, I'll talk with the bad boy chef Eddie Wong about his new memoir, Fresh Off the Boat, a chronicle of his life as the son of Taiwanese immigrants. And Eddie is bringing along one of his favorite artists, the rapper Heems of the late great New York hip-hop group Das Racist. A conversation with Eddie Huang and a performance by Heems on January 31st at 2 p.m. in the Green Space. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is Soundcheck. More now from a recent performance in the Green Space by The Relatives. During the 70s, they blended funk and soul with gospel and made a name for themselves on the Dallas gospel circuit. Now, 40 years after they formed, the Relatives have released their first full-length album called The Electric Word, with a lineup that includes the two founding members, Reverends Gene West and Tommy West, plus longtime singer and percussionist Ernest Tarkington. You can watch the full video of this performance on soundcheck.org. But for now, sit back and enjoy this performance of the song Your Love Is Real. It's The Relatives on Soundcheck.
Me, your
get up in the morning, I don't need nobody to put on my clothes, yeah. When I get up early in the morning, I don't need nobody to lace my shoes. Your love is real to me. Your love is real to me. Your love is real to me. Your love is real to me.
You'll look for me and I'll be gone. I'm going to a place called Calvary, where love and happiness will always be.
Your love is real to me.
Yes, The Relatives, once again, live on Soundcheck in this special video webcast from our ground floor studio, The Green Space. Your love is real. The album's called The Electric Word. It is 40-odd years later, the first full-length release from The Relatives. And, Gene, let me ask you an obvious question. I'm going to ask it anyway. The name of the band, The Relatives, how'd that name come about?
My sister... We were trying to find a name for the group, and my sister, my next to the baby sister, Gladys Simmons, let me give her a plug. Hey,
does she have a new record, too?
She was a part of, she actually named the group.
Okay.
And she claims that, too. Mm-hmm. She said, I name it.
Now, how many Wests are there? I mean, there's you and Tommy, you've mentioned one sister. How many more are there?
Oh, in our immediate family, it was 8 of us.
Okay.
But it's 4 and 2 left, 2 boys and mm-hmm. 3 4 girls. Yeah. Help me count.
And Ernest, are you somehow related to the West family as well?
By the love of Christ, I'm related. I met Reverend West when I was a little boy.
Little boy.
And I traveled and done some work with him. He's been working with me, and he's a great inspiration to me and my family, and I became a part of him. And so to me, I was just like part of the family.
Right. You see what he did there? You see how clever he was at sort of inserting the idea that he might be a lot younger than you and Tommy? The band is The Relatives. So, Tommy, your family, the West family,
yes.
they're pretty well known in Dallas gospel circles, right?
Yeah, they're pretty well known. My whole family, either singers, ministers, prophets, missionaries, they have something to do with the body of Christ, the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So when you said before, I mean, I had mentioned how the band was formed 40 years ago. I should not have implied that for 40 years you've just been a band, because you actually, Tommy, around 1980, sort of stopped with the band to sort of pursue the ministry, right?
Exactly, exactly. And actually, I didn't exactly go right into the ministry in 1980. I did other things. I sung with gospel groups that I formed on my own, and we did some traveling on the road a little bit, you know. And then we come off the road, and then I opened up a nightclub, and we did some things like that. And
really?
I sung in my nightclub. And then I come out of that and went back to the gospel group, and then the relatives came along.
So once you'd built up enough sins in the nightclub, you went back to the church figure out how to take care of all that stuff.
Yeah. He hadn't got converted yet.
And Gene, you have a ministry as well, right?
Yes, yes.
Is it in Dallas?
Yes, sir. Yes, God's Anointed Community Church, 1807 Gallica, on the corner of Gallica and Via B. Dallas, Texas. Yes, sir.
Once you give a guy a chance to plug, he just starts plugging away.
Yes, sir.
We're speaking with and listening to the relatives. How much fun is it, Tommy, to look out at your audience these days and see, like, all these, you know, younger people who many of them weren't even born when you guys were first singing?
It's electrifying. It really is. It's awesome. It's really awesome. I get a charge. I get energy when I look out and they're clapping, they're jumping, and they're, you know, enjoying the music. I really get a charge from that. It's really exciting.
Well, there's a full-length record finally from the relatives called The Electric Word. You guys want to do another song for us here in the green space? We Need Love is the name of it. The Relatives, live on Soundcheck. That's music from The Relatives, the psychedelic gospel group from Dallas, Texas. The song's called We Need Love. And you can watch video of the full performance or listen to the podcast on soundcheck.org. Tomorrow, if you've ever been in a relationship that seemed to be going great until your date started talking about music, well, you've hit a musical red light. We'll hear about the CD collections, the wall posters, the concert tickets that have made your romantic life a little more complicated when our regular guest Faith Saley joins us. Plus, musicians Sean Lennon and Greg Saunier of the band Deerhoof bring their new project Mystical Weapons to our studio for a performance. That does it for today's show. Join us again right here at 9 tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.